The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Stephanie Nadoff, and I am a member of both the Board of Trustees and the Foundation Board of Directors of this great institution. I'm a very proud supporter of the Free Library. I think that the Free Library is really one of the crown jewels of Philadelphia. It's one of its most important educational and cultural institutions, and as you know, it provides the city provides an important part of our funding. It supports the operation and the staffing at most of our, at all of our branches, our 54 branches. But it is through the generosity of individuals, the individual gifts to the Free Library Foundation, that the library can present terrific programs like this author series, programs which promote literacy and enrich the cultural fabric of our city. So I encourage you all to join with us, those of us who contribute to the foundation, and to do that, all you need to do is visit our website, freelibrary.org, and you'll be able to do that. We would really appreciate that. Tonight, it's my pleasure to introduce acclaimed writer and Philadelphia's own, Loreen Carey. Called a powerful storyteller, frankly sensual, and mortally funny, by the New York Times Book Review, Loreen is a writer of both fiction and nonfiction. Her work includes themes of growing up, of education, women's lives, and race. She's the author of the extraordinary and best-selling memoir, Black Ice, which is often taught in colleges and high schools, as well as Pride, a contemporary novel, and of course, the one that we all remember so well. She's the author of our selection for our very first One Book, One Philadelphia, The Price of a Child. What an incredible selection it was. It was 10 years ago, hard to believe. Loreen is also the founder of Art Sanctuary, where more than 10,000 diverse participants enjoy unique programs of excellent African-American arts and letters in inner city Philadelphia. She's also a teacher of creative writing at Penn. I think there's nothing she can't do. For all of these, her arts activism, her teaching, and especially for her outstanding writing, Loreen received the Philadelphia Award, the city's highest civic honor, in 2003. Her new novel, If Sons, Then Heirs, which she'll be discussing with us tonight, recounts a love story for our time while exploring a searing racial history that haunts its unforgettable characters. Publishers Weekly raved about it, saying Carey tells a complex story of family, race, and the challenges of reconciling the present with a persistent past. She pairs generations of loving and loyal individuals with social history, making for an absorbing and moving tale. And one reviewer actually took the words out of my mouth when she said, every single character pops off the page in this amazing story. This masterwork of a novel made me laugh and cry out loud. Important, enjoyable, and wonderfully moving, an absolute delight. Well, it is an absolute delight to have her here with us tonight. So join with me, please, in welcoming Loreen Carey.
Thank you very much, very, very much, Stephanie. I'm delighted, hey, to see folks out here to, I've forgotten my glasses. I got all dooted up and I forgot my glasses. I put on a fresh shirt for you and I took off the glasses and threw it down. If someone happens to go back in there, they're in the red pocketbook, bless your heart. And I have to ask for them because this is a new book, so I don't have any of it memorized yet. You know, with Black Ice, there are some, you know, you read it for 20 years, and after a while, you sort of know. I would like just to read some sections throughout this. Oh. Thank you. Thank you so much. Make sure my cell phone's off, too. That would be very embarrassing. Oh, thank you. Thank you. And thank you so much, Stephanie, for your very kind introduction. I'd like to just read little bits and then talk some and then read some more and try to introduce this book to you. Oh, it's fun to have a book out. God, it's great to have a new book out. Okay. Jewel Thompson nosed her sedan into the narrow Philadelphia street. She had directions on the seat next to her and also the letter. In her mind, a voice from the past, her grandmother's, shouted, "We home!" Which was ridiculous, since she'd never been on this street or even in this section of the city before. Outside her noisy mind, rows of identical two-story brick houses squatted beside Cobbs Creek Park, muffled by heavy fog and a cold early spring, early Sunday morning quiet. She had to drive cautiously. No more than 4 or 5 inches separated her driver's side from the curb or her passenger's side from the parked cars, whose owners had carefully folded in their side view mirrors. She slowed nearly to a stop when she saw house numbers that matched the return address on the letter. They were gold and white, painted on a glossy black brick face. Prim white sills and lintels like shirt cuffs shone through the drizzle, and white lines traced the mortar. When she'd left her house, Jewel had told her husband that she might, depending on the way things looked, knock on the door. Now presented with the reality of this shiny black cookie jar of a building on the misty working-class West Philadelphia street, she doubted she'd have the courage. In front of the house grew a large sycamore that had buckled the sidewalk. At the level of the second floor, mottled limbs reached out over the street and twinkled with tiny white Christmas lights. An extension cord connected them to the second floor window. She couldn't quite see, but it looked as if they drilled a hole in the storm window trim for the cord so as not to have to leave the window open. Jewel smiled to herself. Clever. She imagined that the lights made the little street feel inviting at night. A parking space under the tree beckoned, but it seemed too close and obvious. So she let her car roll forward one car length to a stop sign. Some bright, false part of herself congratulated her on the trip. "There, done. Now I can go home." Instead, she sat motionless at the stop sign. She did not even notice the large red pickup truck behind her until the driver touched his horn. In her rearview mirror, she could see a man of about 30 who seemed to fill the cab. He indicated the parking space under the tree, which he could not maneuver into with her car in the way. The truck would have to swing out very wide. Jewel crossed the intersection, put her foot onto the brake, and checked her rearview mirror again. The big, ochre-colored man was unfolding himself from the cab of the truck and stepping into the street. She shifted in her seat to see him better. He looked familiar. The letter to her was folded in its envelope on the front seat. She'd read its block capital letters so often in the past week, she almost knew it by heart. "Dear Mrs. Jewel Thompson, I am looking for my mother, formerly Jewel Needham, the daughter of Bobo Needham, originally from the town of Gunnarsson in Beaufort County, South Carolina. Please let me know if you are that lady. We lived in New York, in Harlem, I think, until I was about 7. Then I was sent to my grandfather, Bobo Needham, and his stepmother, Selma Needham, in South Carolina, who also raised him. Now I am 30 years old. I am doing well. I am a contractor now and just received my first contract with the city of Philadelphia. I said that I wished I could tell you, and my girlfriend suggested that I write this, and she would try to find an address for me to send it to. I live with my girlfriend, her son. He is about the age I was when I was separated from my mother. That's another reason I'm writing. Watching him grow has made me think about you. I hope that you will agree to meet. If you are not the right person, please let me know. This could be just one meeting, if you like. It doesn't have to be more. Here's my information for home or work. Email or cell is best. Sincerely, Alonzo Rain. That was Lonnie in the truck behind Jewel. She knew it. That's the opening of this book. And you, thank you. I wrote this book three times. This is the third time. I'm hoping, as my mother-in-law said about me to my husband, that the third time's the charm. It was, with me and the book. The other thing, though, is that when you've written a book wrong a couple of times, you know it better. You know, this book for me is like calculus, right? I failed it a bunch of times. And then when I got it, it was gorgeous, right? I could so this one is lived in me. I wanted to do past and present. I wanted to figure out how to make the language very simple and pack it with emotional, intellectual, and spiritual meaning. I wanted all of the joy of a novel. I do not have contempt for the form. Do you remember when we, in the United States, we sent to the UN as a representative from the U.S. a man who didn't believe that the UN should exist? Remember that happened a few years ago? Remember that? There are people writing the novel these days who think the novel is boring and old and fuddy-duddy. And so they try to make it into something else. They try to make it cinematic. It's not cinematic. A novel has the interiority that allows us an intimacy with the story inside that a film does. A film shows you things, and you get this rich, rich visual. A novel doesn't have rich visuals, but it has a rich interiority, and I'm trying to use this medium for what it is. For what it's about. And it can do past and present. It can do interior. It can do spiritual. It can do, and it should do, emotional. In this family, back and forth between Philadelphia and South Carolina, this young man, Alonzo Rain, who was called Rain a lot. Rain has a great-grandmother who raised him. You heard about her, Selma. And Selma and Jones, her brother, had one argument in front of him that he remembered, only one. They love each other. They enjoyed each other. They grew up together. In fact, their father was a tenant farmer on this land that Selma now lives on. And the man who owned the land was named King Needham, and King eventually married Selma. The argument they have is whether to tell Rain about something that is it's sort of a legend there, which is this particular lynching that happened. They argue about it. And Jones eventually tells him, he says, I got to tell him what happened. So he talks. Women brought food and children watched. That's what Lily couldn't understand when she heard the story through Rain. Lily is his girlfriend. Children watched, and they had to remember, Even those who forgot, they remembered too. On Sundays, they had to murmur with his image turning, burning, turning in their minds. Murmur together, shh, softly, whisper it together. Grant us therefore, gracious Lord, so to eat the flesh of thy dear Son, Jesus Christ, and to drink his blood, that we may evermore dwell in him and he in us. Like Jared said, people need a sacrifice. And those who missed the picnic itself could see it later. The photographer used a lightweight camera on a tripod, fast new shutter, and clip-on flash. He pulled black drapes around him to makeshift a dark room and developed photos right in the field. Men who got just $5 a head from the hog reduction program paid 50 cents for a print still wet. The body smoked. After they were outlawed as postcards, the photos traveled the world in envelopes and pockets. They passed from hand to hand, lay in side drawers under baptismal records and Bowie knives. They were inherited with possessions made affordable by black labor until finally, 4 or 5 generations later, Jones begins. All of us know the outlines by heart. Rain finishes. He has in his mind the picture of a black man, neck to one side, hanged. An American icon. Now one could see it in museums and coffee table books. Collectors collected photos. Dirty pictures. Who can touch? Wash your hands. Later they shear off slices of the body. The pieces turn to dust in men's wallets. Like that crazed $100 bill Jones gave him. 'Cause once you've sliced off a man's ear, Rain thinks, what else can you do but keep it close? It's a relic. Touches your fingers every time you go for your money. Loose flakes rub off when you pick up your children. Shake hands with business colleagues to show your goodwill. Open hand, unarmed, charmed, I'm sure. Over the years, the story had cooked inside Rain's head, helped by the comments of the few people he'd ever told. You don't bring it out too often. But wait, here come the miracle, my Lord. Jones holds in his voice the exact hopeful reverence of the sharecroppers who'd shared the news with him. They'd get to this part in the story and shake their heads. And this is what I want you to know too, Jones says, referring to Selma's silence, because if Rain didn't know the first part, then he couldn't know the miracle. That when the mob had done as much as you can do to a human being and him still be alive, a man pushed his way through the crowd, crazy as they were now, crazy mad with liquor and the terrible intoxication of blood, a colored man elbowed his way to the front and begged for the boy's life. That was the part everyone repeated. And then, dude, Jesus, a black man come up in front of him. And it didn't matter whether the listeners had heard the story before. They told it again just as Jones told Rain, and Rain told his construction partner, and later Lily, because it remained a mystery. And because everyone wanted to know this and to learn, as Jones learned, what was possible. Jones's words, present tense, became heroism, because heroism exists outside of time. He stands beside the boy's body, tied by now so that it won't fall flat. This black man says, listen to what he say, stand in front of all these crazy drunk up people. He say, for God's sake, please don't finish this. Whatever you meant to teach him, this boy has surely learned. He'll never be good for nothing anyway now. Please, for pity's sake, just let me take him home. Let me take him home to his mother. Where had he come from? This man who appeared like the black face of God speaking mercy. The outrageousness of it would not be suppressed. It leached out from between the rocks, seeped into the streams, soaked into the swamps. Finally, it ran in the papers, so they couldn't say it didn't happen. Jones was sure that Rain could find it one day in the records. Sure enough, he looked it up on the internet. They go down when Jewel sees Rain in her rear view. He's unpacking his truck, and then he's packing it again to drive down to see Selma. He always goes down on Holy Week, and he always spends that week with her. He drives her to services. He does little things around the farm. She has the old house that his great-great-grandfather built and his great-grandfather improved. She also has a trailer. She stays in the trailer because it's easier to clean and easier, cheaper to heat and all that. So that's the situation. They have this land that has been owned by the Needham family since the Civil War. And there's also another piece of the land that King Needham bought. He added to the heir property. And they're sort of ruled by different laws, different South Carolina laws. Heir property is different from property that you just buy outright. And that's part of what this is all about, what's happening to this land. He wants so much for her to come up and just sell it and get into some nice, quiet, assisted living somewhere. You know, really, because she's down there and she can't keep it up and it's out of control. And, you know, and she just keeps going and going and going. And then she wants him. Well, you know what she wants him to do, right? Come down there and take over. So this is a moment. They're going back to a place that he remembers where he first learned about mermaids. It's in him in the truck. He has his girlfriend's son who has begged his way down. His name is Khalil. And Khalil is down for the week with them. At the intersection of the next little town on either side of the train tracks, Rain left Selma and Khalil in the cab with the engine running and the doors locked while he went into a convenience and package store. They've just asked these guys who are selling drugs in the country street. They're standing in the middle. They just asked them for directions, and there's this whole scene where the guy is talking trash and she tells him, roll up the window and keep driving. Clearly, they don't get the directions. So he goes into a store. When he came out, he was carrying a bag of local hot sauce. On the outside of the bag, four old-timers had collaborated on a pencil-drawn map of the area with Mermaid Landing indicated by a large circled M. He also threw 5 pounds of ice into the ridiculously large cooler he'd found in the old shed, as if they were going to catch a 50-pound black drumfish with 20-year-old line and a number 2 hook. Selma was telling Khalil how to smoke fish and how they'd kept the fish smoking tradition in the family all the way from Africa, and that Grandma Bet said that smoked fish kept them alive for 2 terrible winters in the Civil War. The Civil War? Khalil whispered to himself incredulously in the back seat. When Rain looked into the rearview mirror to discipline him with a glare, Khalil grabbed his cheeks, pulled them down, and rolled his eyeballs upward until only the whites showed. An involuntary, sneezy laugh escaped Rain's nose, but he managed to master his face by the time the eyeballs in the mirror returned to peer at him. They had some terrible winters, Selma was saying. You think it's all palmetto sunshine down here, but it gets bad. We could have terrible winters, too. Rain gave a stern frown to Khalil and drove on toward the river, ignoring the bare foot that poked its way into his peripheral vision, waving, no doubt, a naughty reference to the shoeless child Selma described yet again. Time we get there, Selma said, it'll be time to turn around and go home, because let me tell you, I can't be up cooking no dinner at 10 o'clock tonight again. Y'all hear me? No wonder I fell out. That's too late. I'm having a hard enough time on my pins as it is. Playing around with you young bucks will finish me off for sure. I'm already so stiff, y'all gonna have to pry me out of this truck with a can opener. Rain started laughing then, and Khalil whooped. Selma herself said, it's the truth, and then laughed with him. It'll take y'all half an hour just to set me up on the dock. Oh, Lord, did you bring the blanket? I'm going to tell you something about the Broadnax Field since we was talking about it before. And the Broadnax Field is the little piece that King bought. The old father, Broadnax, kept hogs there, and it was the sloppiest, filthiest, stinkingest operation you ever saw. Contaminate everybody's water. That's why the whites didn't mind King buying it, because they knew he'd clean it up. Well, some years before we bought it, the little shoats would get out and run all over to our place. And we'd make sure to take them back, show them which one it was, tell them where the fence was broke. But this one time, we was coming back from fishing at night. Dark, dark, dark. We almost home. Come up on this fat little shoat. We knew right away whose it is. And King said, he said just like this, "Selma, you think we can can that thing by sunup?" And oh my Lord, good thing it was cold, because we had to work so fast. Selma remembered King slaughtering the shoat with the fish knife, the mess of it, dragging it home in the fish buckets, blood enough to slosh as the wagon rocked in the cold, clear night, stoking up the old stove to boil the thing piecemeal. Faces greasy with condensation. They met the morning by piling manure into the wagon to sop up the blood. It was that night, chewing crackling, that King and Selma first got the idea to buy the place outright. You know, in doing this book, what I wanted very much to do was to get a sense. To give a sense of this complicated community. Now, Stephanie has said very kind things about the price of the child, but the fact is that many people couldn't be bothered with the price of a child because it was like eating your Brussels sprouts. I know that. Okay, I know. People said it was good for you. White people said, "Oh my goodness, I'm so glad. Thank you for writing that." And then they left the room, right? Totally. Black people said, "Yo, sister, I'm glad you threw down. You told us what was real. You talked about that." And then they left the room too, right? Because it was like slavery, no thank you. No, thanks very much. No thank you. No thank you. And because it was one book, because the mayor said you had to read it, because there were posters up, people said, when they read it, thanks be to God, they read it. What I wanted so much to do here, though, was, and one of the reasons, though, that it is hard to do is that I'm trying to create a sense of the community that I've grown up in, that I've known, that I've worked in. And that's a community that is very complex. It's a community where there are so many things happening to people all the time that one of the things my editors write me back and they said early on was, "This is just too much going on. All this couldn't possibly happen to one family." And I wrote one or two. I don't like to write sharp emails back to people. There's no profit in it at all. But I did need to stop, and I just said to this one person, "Let me tell you what has happened this week in my privileged, very privileged life with the people in the circle around me." And I put everything that had happened that week into this book, just because. So on top of everything else that was in the book, I put that into. So there. My daughter's good friend had a 2-year-old girl who was diagnosed with cancer. I put her in. My dear friend, my very, very close friend, who has raised the sons, left orphaned at her sister's death. One of them was their very good friend was in a car. They were devastated, driving this car with the young man, and the police came after because there was something wrong with the car. Something was wrong with his license. He was very afraid of getting arrested. He drove faster and faster, and he crashed the car, and they both died. Also in that week, someone else I knew had a financial crash and were put out of their house. This had happened within 3 or 4 days. This is a community, right? These are the challenges that people have. And I live a totally privileged life. I live an enchanted life, right? I live a life completely and totally stoked by scholarship money. I do, right? I've had jobs, I have skills, I get all kinds of great stuff happening. And still, I got to say that that's one of my challenges in writing a book, is how do you figure out how to get that in without making the reader so confused and so overwhelmed, and making sure that you do go deep and not just wide, right? That you don't write one of those books where just stuff happens. Or as my husband says, one damn thing after another. And you don't get to know anybody. You don't get to love it. But you need that sense of it. So that's, for me, that's one of the formal challenges. And I was trying very hard to answer it in this book by doing the other thing, of course, God help us, is you got to have the presence of the ancestors, right? This is African American, they're always there. Always. Always there. Christianity notwithstanding, we still got ancestor worship all over the place. So there is memory that the individual characters have. There's memory that that is evoked. And then there's the present that's tinged by and influenced by the past. Daddy told us, now here's what Jesus said, Selma is telling Rain. He said, I say unto you, though he will not rise up and give him because he is his friend, yet because of his persistence will he rise and give him as many as he need. Ask and it shall be given. Daddy told us to pray for mother and the babies, and all I knew was Jonesy went and got an old apple from the horse's bucket and bit out the worm and all the rot in the middle around the seeds and fed me from his hand, and finally I went to sleep. Now, this is during the flu epidemic. Jonesy and Selma, the brother and sister, are well, but their family is very ill with the flu, and the father makes the two of them come out of the house and stay in this barn. This is her remembering it. Later, after Daddy died too, and it was just me and Jones, I remember what Daddy said. You know what I pray for? I pray for King. Every night from time I was 9 years old and he taught me the times tables, I told God that I was asking in the name of Jesus and that I ask every day and every night for the rest of my life. On my 12th birthday, Mr. King Needham sent his son Junior over to give me two chickens of my own to raise. And less than 5 years later, he married me. King Needham married the skinny little scattergood gal from the shack. He bought me a beautiful dress, and they threw a little party after. And you think he'd married the Black Queen of Sheba the way he talked to me so gentle and carried me into the house over the threshold in front of all his relatives? He told me I was smart. He told me I was beautiful. Rain had slowed to just below the speed limit and drove almost reverently onto their old road, so familiar and yet new in light of Selma's persistent will and love, whose remnants he had felt now as constraints rather than freedom. Selma walked over the threshold in her mind now, back into the bedroom. Mr. King, as she had called him all her life, never touched her until the first night. When it came, he pulled her into him and kissed her, mouth open and smiling. He kissed his way into her, rumbling low in his chest with delight. Tastes good. Then he laid her down on his bed like an offering unto himself. That's what she felt like, and ran his big hands lightly over her tight skin. Call my name, Mr. King. No Mr. Now, baby. King, I can't call you that. She laughed into the darkness, conscious of her appeal, feeling herself shiver under his rough hand with its missing fingers. But when he stood to slough off his shirt and his shoulders blotted out the moonlight, her girlish desire turned to fear. Maybe I ain't big enough for you.
You're big enough if you want it.
I'm scared.
You don't want it, I could wait.
I've been wanting it since I was little. Oh, don't tell me that, oh Lord. I dreamed I was lying up here in this bed. Every night I dreamed it. Oh Jesus, stop saying that, girl. I snuck up here and looked in the window.
Well, then you're big enough now.
He made love to her twice on their wedding night as gently as he could, he said, given how long he'd waited and how young and how sweet she was. Then he fell asleep. Still tingling and tender, every inch of her awake, she ran her hand along the contour of his huge, pale body, holding her palm just half an inch over his torso to feel the warmth and the coiled-up energy in his chest. One flesh. This was the blessing she had prayed for. Her real life had begun. So that's Selma. That's Selma. Andy's here. We can talk a little if you like.
So I think most of you know how this works. Raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you. Who'd like to start us off?
There's always a little bit of a wait, but it's okay.
Well, I could start us off. There's something in the... Oh, I'll withhold the gentleman here.
I'm glad you got your glasses. You're a good reader. I, for specific reasons, enjoyed your first nonfiction book very much, and I wondered if you might return ever to nonfiction or if you've moved on to novels now completely.
No, I love nonfiction. And in fact, I'm working now on a... Working is too grand a term. I'm dreaming, planning, wishing, taking notes, doing little tiny bits of research on a nonfiction project that really has to do with all of this interest here in the African American community in the forts on the west coast of Africa and that whole sort of triangle. I have just a comment in one book about how it's by someone who's from Africa, from Ghana, who says that Americans come, you know, they go to the forts, oh, they cry, and then they go home, they're so happy, right? And that, but I can't stop thinking about that relationship between, you know, those of us here and those places. So I am actually working on a nonfiction project that, where I would go there and study some of those places. I actually wrote half a script for a movie and did a lot of research reading the journals of the captains of slave ships. It was unbelievable. And these are things, and for me, writing always comes with the stuff that I can't get out of my mind. I actually teach nonfiction. I love writing nonfiction. I still write magazine articles. And have begun, because you have to when you write a book, you have to blog your butt off. I begin going back to some of the nonfiction and really thinking about it and writing, and I love writing about place. My favorite place to write about is Philadelphia, but I'd love to go there and write about that relationship back and forth. Yes, sir. Thanks. Do you have a relationship with St. Paul's School?
Yes.
Yes.
Another question? Lady off to our left, and then we'll head all the way back there.
Hi, I'm Ms. Carrie. Because of a recent tragedy in my life, have started to write, and it's very cathartic.
And so I recently contributed an essay for WHYY This I Believe. And since then, I've been listening. And I caught your essay a little while ago. And I was riveted by how well you speak and write. And that relationship and asthma just drew me in. Mm-hmm. So I'm just determined to buy everything that you have ever written. So I got two down. So I have your new book and also The Price of a Child, which I will read and not leave the room because I'm strong like that.
Just get through the first three chapters and then it's okay.
I can do it. I know I can do it. But my question, and I was so nervous I had to write it down. You know, when you started writing a few years ago, what would you say that you've held on to from the beginning of your journey as an author that you feel has sustained you all these years?
That's a good question. What have I held on to? The practice of it. The practice of it. That's where you live. You live in the practice. It focuses me. It's not meditation. But it is practice. And I mean that as meditators or as Buddhists say, it is practice. And in that way, you can use it like any other exercise that keeps you strong. So that's it. And the other stuff you learn to do. I mean, publishing is a learned activity. Reading out loud for me is a learned activity. I practice this. I worked on it. I listened to myself. I looked in the mirror. I have my daughter, she dresses me. I figure out all of this is learned. The real action for me is in that room. And there are many of them where it's just me and the work, fiction or nonfiction, but it's the practice. It's a discipline. And the discipline, I mean it like from Discipuli, you know, meaning student. I am a student of this work. And it continues to teach me. You know, at our sanctuary, we're always talking about a learning culture. And everybody says it. Everybody talks about having a learning culture because that's the word. But really, do you have a discipline that you keep coming back to where you have to learn more? And one of the things you have to keep is you have to keep the honesty. You have to keep learning. So you keep learning more. I think that's it. Thank you.
All the way back there.
Loreen, yes. As we were listening to Stephanie recite everything that you do, Susan and I were sitting here saying, how does she find the time to write a book which takes so much focus? What's your method of writing? When do you write? How do you do it?
I, throughout my adult life, from the time I was about 30 or 32 or 3, I have been writing a book almost continuously the whole time. Before that, I wrote magazine articles. Every book requires its own strategy and discipline. So that when I was writing a book and had one young daughter, there were certain... I had to figure out how to write that book for that time in my life. So I don't just have one way of writing. For this last book, because I was unable really to focus and concentrate long enough to do it right, for this last rewrite, the third total revision, I actually started going once a week to a hotel because it was the only place that I could get away from everything that was needed. At the time, we had elder care. My grandmother was living with us as well, and I couldn't be alone enough in my house, even though it's a big house, and I could go up to the third floor, and there was a room, and I had computers, but I couldn't be alone enough, you know, because if something occurred to her, she would say, Lorene, you know, and what do I do? You know, so I started going to a hotel, and then a friend said, why are you spending my, and I would get the, I would hotwire at work on Friday, so any place that had $50, I would go there. But it's still, it's 50, but I mean, you know, I got another kid to go to college, it's not nothing, right? So a friend said, why are you doing that? You can come to my house. And she gave me, the two of them gave me keys, and I went there every Friday. Sometimes I would leave work early at 3, sometimes I would work till 11 or 12 and just come there. Doing that, for this book, I needed it because I had too many jobs. I could still work, I could still find a time. You can always, and nobody can tell me you can't unless you're imprisoned or something and people won't let you. Almost all of us can find an hour in our day to write, right? Most of the time, you can squeeze 2 or 3 hours. 3 is a lot, but you can get up really early. You can stay up late. You can figure out something. If I can get 3 hours is a good writing day, really. You just have to figure out how to have the energy to live 2 or 3 lives. So you have to have your writing day. Then you make your kid your lunch or breakfast or something. Then you go to work. Then you come home. Then you do Sunday school, whatever you do. Like, but you just have to have the energy to keep it going. But if you put the writing up early before the to-do list gets in the way, you can keep going. But what I couldn't do was stay in the book, right? I couldn't stay in it with 3 hours. But that one overnight meant that I could write, I could sleep, I could come there, I could write all night. Sometimes I would come in, I'd just fall asleep. But then I'd wake up at 3 a.m. and I could write through till Saturday noon, which is when I left and went home. So for this book, that was the discipline I needed. For this next book, I will need to go to Ghana. That will be a different discipline. But it's still figuring out when I can do that 1 to 3 hours a day of writing. And now because, so let's face it, so I was teaching at Penn, now I'll do it 3 or 4 times a week. And now what I've decided is that since there is the, I will do blogging instead, and I'll figure out a way to write blogs that are useful to me as a writer. The other thing is never take writing assignments that are trivial and do not help you grow as a writer. I don't care who tells you it's good. I don't care how good it is for business. It is, if it screws your writing, what do you have? You know? And if you've sold some books and your writing is in the trash and you're not honest, and you haven't thought more, and you haven't become smarter, and you haven't become emotionally more aware. You know, all we're doing is like you. You're mining your emotional landscape. You're mining it. You put those little guys down there. They cough. They sputter. Sometimes they learn things. Sometimes they never come back up. You killed them. You killed them because you don't want to be honest. And they're down there saying, really? Really? You really are scared of this. And you just close off that, wall that off, and they're in there. That's what you're mining. So the writing has to be worth it. Or else do something else. Make money. Have babies. Do something, you know. But don't write if it's trash. What's the point?
Lady in the third row here.
Okay.
Hey. Hi. I'm curious about what's next. You talked about Ghana and, doing the nonfiction. Have you also been approached or thought about any of your books going to film? You knew I was going there.
I have been approached. I have been approached. Until now, my books haven't been film books, though. You know, so people get them and they sort of like the idea, but then it's it's a few small changes. You know, my husband said, can we see Goldie Hawn in the lead? You know, it's like or often we want triumph at the end. I don't do triumph. Doesn't feel true to the experience, right? Or flat out, total give it up tragedy where, you know, everybody is just laid out on the ground and we enjoy the fact that they're all dead. There's not enough. No, there's not a happy ending and there's not a totally, it's a little this, little, it's a book ending. It's a book ending. For a book, I try to give endings that are, give you closure and satisfaction, but they're not movie endings. So there's that. I have had all the books optioned. No, but I would sell it if they'd pay me some money for it. I keep telling you, I got a kid to go to college. I keep telling you that. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for coming here this evening. I've had the fortune of reading two of your books, and I got my third here.
Yay.
But I just recently learned about Free, the Stories of the Underground Railroad, which I think is an excellent idea. And where was this book when my daughter was a young adult? I mean, so I'm curious about what inspired you to write this, because it's a wonderful book.
Oh, good. What inspired me was two things. Actually, the one book, One Philadelphia, really did sort of jack me up to that, because I ended up doing a lot of storytelling during that time for people who would bring their children along, because Price of a Child was not a children's book. It was not appropriate for children. Actually, I wrote one of those stories to go on the Free Library's website, so there would be a story that children could read. And I try to write it at like a sixth grade level. And then there's a wonderful woman named, what was her name? She's a poet. C and R are her initials, and she translated it into Spanish. So we had it both in English and Spanish at a children's level on the website. And what I wanted to do, the other thing that inspired me was my own children. So I had already done... The reason I could do that storytelling was that when I was doing the Price of a Child research, reading William Still's book and all of the books that and stories and documents, I was furious. I wanted to know why I didn't know this. I've lived in Philadelphia all my life. Where were these things? And you know, why weren't these around? William Still's book is there, but it is he self-published it in 1872. It reads like 1872, right? And we have a modern sensibility. So I needed to figure out ways to make it interesting to my own children. And I wanted them to read a book with agency, African-American agency. I did not want them told the story that there were black slaves and there were white liberators only. Yes, there were white liberators. Thank God for them. Bless them. There were also, in this whole process, the people themselves who risked running need not to be treated like objects in the story. Do you know what I mean? As well as the free people, free black people who helped them, who were overlooked. So I wanted to tell that liberation story from the point of view of the people who were working to liberate themselves. We did a three-part improv in my older daughter's second grade class, so like 20 years ago, almost. with one of the women who ran away, a woman in a box. And when I watched what happened to the kids in that, I brought in a U-Haul box, and we put the box out, told them the story, wrote the story, and had three parts to it because they like a three-part story, beginning, middle, and end. And then I showed them how, you know, I'm a regular medium-sized grown-up. There's nothing small, particularly small about me. But really, you know, you can get a U-Haul box, and as a grown-up, you can just get down into it and, you know, sort of get in. And then they see this box that's, you know, a little bit like this. They see this box there, and you're gone. And I let, and they tape it, and they hammer it closed. And then they remembered what the story had said, which is how dark it is inside. And they remembered, I remember saying to them, and I'll never forget, I asked them, and they, you know, and the smart kids at the front put their, what about this? And then I said, well, why would they tuck straw all around her, this lady who was going to be mailed north. Why would they put straw? So she didn't hurt herself. Ooh, so she didn't hurt her head. Ooh, so she didn't get bruised. Ooh, so she didn't. And then there's one little boy in the back who says, so she wouldn't pee. He knew. He knew that urine in the box would very much let people know what was in this box that they should know about. And then they all got silent. And at that point, they were engaged in this story in a whole new way. I came out of the box and asked who wanted to get in. And the agency involved meant that every kid raised a hand. The boys raised their hand, wanting to pretend to be this pregnant woman in a box. The white kids asked to get in. Because it was about agency. It had stopped being, we had stopped allowing race to be the equivalent of shame. And now it was about people running for their lives. And everybody wanted to be part of it. So I already had that experience. And I could do that with kids. Doing the one book one, I called on that. I called on other stories I knew. And a group of teachers said, teachers actually at Springside School said, we want those stories available. Can't you write them? They should be available. So that's sort of where it came from.
They're available upstairs, and they're actually being reprinted by Temple University
yes.
Press, I just learned. Mm-hmm. So please join me in thanking Lorene Carey.
Thank you. Upstairs, okay.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.